This episode of Warp 5 is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 150,000 titles for your smartphone, tablet, or desktop. To get a free audiobook of your choice, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. Also, help us keep Star Trek discussion coming to you each day by becoming a Trek FM patron through Patreon. Get access to exclusive content and become part of the team. You'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm.
Hi, I'm Anthony Montgomery, Ensign Travis Mayweather on Star Trek Enterprise, and you're listening to Trek FM.
How we doing, Trip?
Ready when you are.
Prepare for warp.
Course laid in, sir. Request permission to get underway.
Let's go.
Welcome, everyone, to Warp 5, our dedicated Enterprise show. I'm your host, Norman Lau, and thank you for joining us once again for another episode in the conference room aboard the NX-01. And we're incredibly excited this evening because we are recording our very first subspace postcards episode for Warp 5. Now, subspace postcards is a little nod to the Enterprise episode Horizon. Thanks to Christopher Jones for giving us that tidbit of trivia. And we love Horizon because I think we've talked about Horizon pretty consistently for the last couple of episodes. But it's a great episode, so go watch it. So this past week, I put out a feeler to the fans on the Babel Conference, our Trek FM dedicated Facebook listeners page, and we received an overwhelming list of ideas from our fans, and we'd like to share several of these ideas with you. Now, I think you'll enjoy the topics we've chosen for this episode, and maybe it will prompt you or inspire some of you to let us know what you'd like to hear in the future on the show. And for those listeners out there who sent us ideas and we didn't quite just get to them in this episode, please be patient with us because you had great ideas, and some of them may even show up in later episodes for their own focus because we just feel very strongly about some of that content. So thanks for listening, and thanks for all of your enthusiasm and support, and I promise you we will get to those subjects in future episodes. Now, on a more somber note, as we record this episode, it's the evening of February 27th, and I'm sure that many of you have been informed today about the passing of our very own beloved and revered Leonard Nimoy, Mr. Spock. And we will definitely discuss his passing and what it meant to us later on in the show. But we have a ton of great show ready for you and a lot of fun topics to discuss. So let's get down to it. We have back with us in the conference room our content coordinator, Will Nguyen, and he's present and accounted for, and I'm glad he's surviving his Andorian winter. Will, how are you?
It's good. It stopped snowing, so I mean, that is a huge step forward. We still have all this snow and ice on the ground, but at least there's no new accumulation, so that's definitely a huge plus.
That sounds good, and hopefully it won't be too long now before you get at least, what, above single digits? Are you in double digits now weather-wise?
I think we're about 15 to 20, which feels like summer. Like, that's how cold it's been, that when it reaches 20, you're like, ooh, I can go out grilling, I can wear a short-sleeve shirt.
Crack the windows down in the car.
Pretty ridiculous, actually. Yeah.
And back with us in his first broadcast from here in the conference room on the NX-01, the man behind the Star Trek Horizon movie, Tommy Kraft. Tommy, how are you?
I'm lovely. Thank you for having me. Actually, for the first time ever in the conference room.
Yeah. How do your legs feel? A little stretched out? It's like kick back a little bit now?
Oh, yeah. It's great. And, you know, the lighting is nice up in here. It's not that off blue color. So I'm digging it.
You know, the cool thing about the conference room is that we have access now to some control panels where Hoshi can pipe us some, wait for it, subspaced postcards. That's right, because that's the topic of this episode.
And I love how when you say the conference room, it's like how a wrestling announcer would say, "Welcome to the Octagon," but it's like the conference room, just like every other conference room.
Well, you gotta make it sound at least a little bit interesting.
Like, it's as if we're talking about a conference room as if it never existed before. Like the decon chamber, it's like, we have something called the conference room that we can sit in now.
Well, for our listeners, we have to make sure that this it's a very special image in their mind. So we are in the conference room reading our very first subspace postcard. So from the Babel conference, Davis Grayson sent us this idea to talk about. And it's a pretty cool topic because we've actually come up with this idea before. But since everyone's on board with it, we decided to throw this up as the number one point. And this is junior officers on the NX-01, a la the episode Lower Decks. So obviously we've seen the bridge crew and the main staff. You have Archer and you have T'Pol and Trip and Reed and Mayweather and so on and so forth and Phlox down in Medbay. But there is an entire ship with an entire crew complement of crewmen, non-commissioned officers and ensigns, and then eventually in season 3 we'll have Makos. Would it not have been interesting to have seen an episode very much like the Next Generation's Lower Decks to try and just get a feel of what's going on, kind of like on the other side of the room? You know what I mean? And just to see how these people are getting along, who they are, what do they do on a daily basis, who they interact with. Have you guys ever seen the fan film, the Red Shirt Diaries?
I have not, but I've heard of it.
It's a really neat concept where the host of the show, and forgive me, I forget her name right now, but what happens is that she encounters the main crew in the off-screen capacity when they walk through a corridor or when they walk through the mess hall or where they go into a turbo lift. And I think that's kind of like would have been neat here to see all of these junior officers or crewmen or non-coms or even Makos start up conversations with the main crew or the main cast and just see the world and the Enterprise in a different light. So what do you guys think about that concept? How would you even consider doing something like that? And what characters would you like to see or bring in to an episode like Lower Decks for Enterprise?
I think, obviously, Crewman Cutler, we just did an episode with her about 2 weeks ago, and she, for me, is almost like the O'Brien of Enterprise, or could have been the O'Brien. So she's one of the premier or one of the recurring characters that shoots up to the top of anyone's list, my list certainly, in terms of recurring characters that could really fulfill that Lower Decks function and really illustrate that different perspective of the crew. So definitely Crewman Cutler. I would say, I remember in Lower Decks, remember Ben is the bartender, right, on in 10 Forward. So it'd be really interesting. I know that there was a running gag for a long time in Enterprise that we don't see Chef, right? But if they're supposed to do a Lower Decks episode, Chef could have been that pivot point. Chef could have been the Ben character in Enterprise, where he interacts with both the senior crew, senior staff, but he also interacts well with the Lower Decks crew. So he's the pivot point, and he's the relay point in terms of, you know, telling the Lower Deck crewmen, you know, what the senior officers might be thinking, or providing that perspective that they might not be seeing because they're actually the senior staff is their commanding officers. The chef possibly could be a civilian that is outside of that chain of command that everyone could talk to and could be open with. So I think Chef would have obviously been a great addition to that type of episode. Elizabeth Cutler, absolutely. And for the remaining spots, it could really just be open in terms of the creators coming up with their own characters to fill that slot. And hopefully it would carry on just beyond, hopefully, one episode. You know, Lower Decks, unfortunately, was just one episode. But ideally, if they were to do this approach, I'd like to at least see it stretched out to a few episodes that you check in with this crew or this second, the Lower Decks part of the crew, you know, once or twice every season. I think that'd be really great.
I think some of the problem is there just aren't enough. At this point, there aren't enough people on Enterprise, other characters that aren't the main cast, that we could focus on. So they'd have to be written. We'd have to come up with some. And I think the show that really did this the best was Deep Space Nine. When you think about the number of really good characters they had on that show that weren't regulars, you had Dukat, you had Garak, you had Nog, Rom, what's her face?
Zial?
Well, yeah, Zial too. I was thinking also of Rom's wife.
Lita?
Oh, Lita.
Yeah, Lita. That's right. All I could think of was her real name. and probably some others. And then, of course, you had the Founders and other characters that I probably can't think of. The Klingons, for example. You had
Martok,
Gowron. It's just they had a lot of really great recurring characters that they could focus on that weren't necessarily main cast. And I wish more shows, not just Star Trek or Enterprise, but I wish more shows would do this in general, because there is this tendency to focus on like the core 5 to 10 main characters and nothing else. And then it feels like you have a ship of 1,000 people where only 8 people are the ones that ever do the work. And so I think it would have been nice if they could have just had little people that not to say I wish they had little people. That could be fine too. But little roles that they could throw in from time to time, where if you're a fan of the show, you recognize, hey, this is crewman so-and-so. They were in it a few episodes ago, etc. Instead of just random extra of the week. And also on top of that, I just think what would be a really interesting Star Trek show, just to throw it out there, is a show that focuses not on the captain and the main crew, but like an ensign or a lieutenant, or maybe something along the lines of the Elite Force video game, where you had the Hazard team and it focused on them instead of the main crew. I just think that would be one of my main complaints in Enterprise, is that they just didn't do really enough with the Lower Decks.
Well, when I was watching Lower Decks earlier, one of the cool things was is that it really did, like 90% of the episode was really about these fresh-faced young officers and letting them interact in a very official capacity with their reports, their direct reports, or their superior officers. And I think that we started to see that a little bit with Crewman Cutler, because she was working with Dr. Phlox so closely. I think this would have been a really good opportunity for Crewman Daniels to have ingratiated himself with even some of the younger officers like Hoshi and Travis, and that would have given you the opportunity to flesh out their characters a little bit better and to even possibly weave in an underpinning of what was going on with this temporal Cold War, because you got to see Daniels a little bit more and in not such a clandestine capacity where all of a sudden, dun, 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 Daniels comes in and major plot point has to be dropped in there, because anytime you see him, it's about the temporal Cold War. It would have been really cool to have seen him earlier just kind of weave his way in there as this any-name crewman doing things here and there. I mean, he was kind of serving in the almost like a yeoman capacity to Archer in his ready room, serving him breakfast and whatnot for Chef. So that would have been a neat thing, just to be able to kind of flesh that character out a little bit more and not have him so heavy so early on, you know, as this focal point for the temporal Cold War.
Daniels was one of my biggest complaints in that regard, because I always thought, like you said, it would have been really cool if, even if it was only one or two episodes before episode 10, where he was first revealed, if you just saw him bring Archer's meal. And that could have been all they needed, was just, you know, Daniels brings Archer's meal in episode 2 or whatever. And then you see in episode 10, oh, wait, there's something more to this guy.
Well, if it looks like a red herring and it smells like a red herring, it eventually will be a red herring, you know, so.
Was that the first time a male was depicted as a yeoman?
Well, at least in the progression of Enterprise to the original series, I think so.
Yeah.
But again, it would have been neat because for Daniels to have been this very vanilla-esque type character that reported back to Chef, and then if you wanted to do Chef as a character, the dialogue between Daniels and Chef would have been really cool, because now you got see the off-camera reaction to what was going on after a conversation between, say, T'Pol, Tripp, and Archer, or Vanek, you know, when during the comet episode, the breaking the ice episode.
Yeah.
So that would have been pretty interesting.
It doesn't have to be a red herring, though, either, when you think about it. If they had really committed to the idea of a Lower Decks group of characters, Daniels could have just been one of them. He could have just been one of those other, like, nameless, not necessarily nameless, but one of those other ensigns or crewmen that you see from time to time. And nobody would have thought more of it, because they'd have a number of those characters. And then,
The payoff would have been better, you know.
Right, exactly. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. And it would have been also neat not just to see crewmen from Starfleet, but when they brought the Makos in,
yeah.
I agree, Tommy, it would have been really neat just to have had a Mako-centric focused episode, very much like when Picard, the Four Lights episode, I'm terrible with these episode names, but Chain of Command, part one and two. It would have been neat to have seen it from like that infiltration style episode from the point of the Makos, and even have Major Hayes kind of like as the leader of that episode,
right?
Versus like versus one of the Starfleet officers. That would have been really cool. What do you think?
I think that would have been great, and I think a lot of this is just part of a lot of it has to do with the time the Enterprise was being made. Where if you watch most shows nowadays, like really current shows, they're constantly developing sub stories, B stories, C stories of the series. Whereas even 10, 15 years ago, TV shows tended to be much more standalone. They didn't tend to develop these stories over time that the fan would recognize, but the average viewer wouldn't care about. For instance, Hoshi and Travis, you know, we're told that they're friends. We see them talking like once or twice, but they could have really developed that for the fans, and they never did. And I think that's just a lot of that is a byproduct of the end of the last era of TV, where things always had to be much less serialized.
And I feel like it's also a product of the public and popular perception of Star Trek, of having those weekly adventures, and really only Deep Space Nine. And, you know, Enterprise had those arcs as well later on, but definitely the first season, the first two seasons, really, you could just tell Enterprise was, you know, it had to serve three or four different masters.
Yeah.
And, you know, the fact that it's still surprisingly good, despite the fact that it really had to service often competing objectives, you know, speaks volumes. But yeah, I mean, it definitely is, you know, from the get-go, they have the temporal Cold War from Broken Bow, but then every other episode for a while is
up till episode 10.
Right? Yeah, and it's just, you know, where are they going with this? And I feel like they were, from the get-go, they were just dealt a really bad hand.
You mentioned DS9, and DS9 suffered from the same problem of they weren't willing to fully commit to developing overarching stories, because even like I remember when I was rewatching DS9 not long ago, and season 7, it's like the beginning of season 7, Dominion War, and the entire rest of the season up until like the last 8 episodes, nothing. And I think the story really suffers from that, because you lose the feeling of like this really epic wartime, like everybody's in danger, etc. And it's the same, and it goes down to even less stories too, of developing relationships and characters for the crewmen and what have you. And DS9 did do that well, but I think Enterprise really kind of, it would have fit Enterprise perfectly considering how small the ship is. That's why I wish they would have done it, because you had such a great opportunity for like this first small band of explorers where you would know everyone's name, because that's the kind of ship it is.
Right. I don't want to, again, get off on too much of a tangent.
Yeah.
I think they do ramp it up in the last, you know, 10 episodes. And I feel like, you know, there is a balance. There's, for me, something that's super serialized is tough for me to rewatch. So I love Battlestar Galactica. I love Breaking Bad. But it's so rare for me to just, hey, I'm going to put on an episode of Breaking Bad.
Right, because you have to watch the whole thing.
Because you'll pull yourself out of the flow. Right.
Exactly. But for something like Deep Space Nine, it's literally my favorite show, because I could literally put it on all the time, and you could jump in on any random episode, and you can get the deeper story if you want, or you can have a standalone episode. So it adds a rewatchability that sometimes a super serialized show like Better Call Saul, like I just can't watch, you know, the second episode and just, you know,
right,
turn that on.
I just wish they would address these overarching storylines more throughout the course of a season. It doesn't necessarily have to be every episode is completely tied to the next, but like with the temporal Cold War, it was like episode 1, then nothing until episode 10, and then nothing until the season finale. And
yeah, that's fair.
It's the same thing with the crewmen too. You know, we saw Cutler twice, and even before she passed away, they had an entire season where they could have used her. And
season 2.
Yeah, and they didn't. And so I don't know why some of those choices were made, And like I said, some of it could be due to the time when the show was made. But it's things I think could have benefited the show.
Well, the overarching story format was a new thing. And a lot, I'm sure the studios, when they took a look at that, the proposition for that will be like, that sounds really good, but I'm not sure if it's going to tie in the viewers. So that, right. I think that's always a risk. That just goes, you know, straight to a numbers game when it comes to production of the show.
Well, it's because it's what the average audience doesn't want, and the studio knows that, because your typical average audience member is going to come home after a long day at work and they just want to put something on.
Right, they just want to pop something on TV, right, and not have to worry about
where
they are in the show.
Yeah, you're going to have a much harder time getting viewers if they have to stay completely caught up on a show every week, and if they can't tune in to season 5 and just know what's going on.
You know, I think that probably the storyline, the way that they wanted to do it for Enterprise, would be a little bit more successful now, because I think they've actually had more successes with these overarching...
Yeah, I agree.
I mean, these long overarching seasons, especially with something like a Breaking Bad or a Battlestar, but... You know, that's for a completely other podcast. So in wrapping up this first point, my last personal pet request for an episode like this was to see Rock Ingersoll join the Makos, because I love Guy Fliegman from Galaxy Quest, and I think he deserved a shot at defending the Enterprise NX-01. So just for me.
Who?
Rock Ingersoll, security chief.
Oh,
the NESA protector.
Sam Rockwell, right?
Yeah.
Oh.
I love Sam Rockwell.
Good luck getting Sam Rockwell to be on Enterprise.
And when everyone, when this podcast drops, people are going to be like, yeah. And they're going to have the exact same thing. They're like, oh my gosh, yes, I love Rock Ingersoll. Who?
Oh, man.
So, all right.
And he has the mustache, too.
So we'll have him audition.
I mean, it's not like he's a big movie star anymore. Like,
right.
Yeah, Enterprise, yeah, I'll Sam totally Rockwell. Do that. Okay.
It's not like he got, like, you know, main villain in Iron Man 2 or anything, because, you know, I'm sure he could afford our budget. Or we could afford him, I should say.
The most important thing to have on your show is a villain who can do a nice little soft shoe from one side of the stage to the other, because that's talent, my friends.
That's true.
That's true. That was a great scene.
So speaking of talent, getting on to our next subspace postcard, Jay Christian, also from the Babel Conference, requested if we could talk about people, talent, that auditioned for the show and didn't make it, or if someone was repurposed for another character. So here are a couple of interesting tidbits I was able to dig up from the interwebs. Could you imagine Admiral Forrest Von Armstrong as Saval?
Whoa.
Because he auditioned for the role of Saval.
I actually did not know that.
I could see that. Yeah. Because I haven't read the actual Memory Alpha article, but I do remember reading somewhere that Von Armstrong has actually played a lot of Trek characters.
A lot of aliens too, right?
A lot of aliens, and he can lose himself in a lot of those roles. Obviously, a Vulcan is less prosthetics than some of his other roles, but I think I remember reading that Von Armstrong is, you know, kind of like the Jeffrey Combs in a way of really coming up in a lot of these recurring roles, and people don't really realize that's him, and he just does a really terrific job losing himself in those roles, so to speak. So I could see it, but I mean, Gary Graham is pretty amazing as Saval, so I don't know. I could be biased by that, but I mean, you know, if we were to rewrite history, like I could see Von pulling it off.
Someone out there for our listeners group is going to have to do a really cool Photoshop and post it online. And just to see the difference between, you know, Von Armstrong in his Admiral Forrest uniform and maybe just a nice headshot of him wearing Saval's robes, and vice versa, having Gary Graham without makeup and taking a headshot of his and putting it in the Admiral's uniform for Starfleet. That would be pretty cool.
Yeah, that would be.
Just because they're so transfixed in those characters for the show, it's hard to kind of like mentally... change the order there. So that'd be kind of neat.
Another fun tidbit is Rico Anderson, who's actually in Star Trek Renegades. He plays one of the, what are they, a Siphon or something like that? The guys with all the huge makeup. And he also plays a Vulcan ambassador in Horizon, my film.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah, he auditioned for Travis back in the day.
Now, how far did he get?
I actually don't know, because I just remember it was either him or Ryan Husk. One of them was telling me that he auditioned for Travis, and that's actually all I know. But that's the fun fact.
No, that's very cool. And during the auditioning process for Enterprise, I know from watching the news footage from when Enterprise was first released, I mean, there was an open casting call and there were a lot of actors and actresses applying for the roles. And one of the, and I don't want to say this in a bad way, but one of the probably most pivotal casting decisions they had to make is for the captain, you know. And I know that Scott Bakula wasn't everyone's most resounding yay for, you know, when they released the information on who's playing who for Enterprise, probably because everyone, now we've done Archer before, we've done Archer in the last two consecutive, almost nearly consecutive episodes, but I remember the fans didn't really kind of scream out, oh my gosh, we finally got the captain that we wanted in this period. There was another actor that was considered for the role, and would you believe that he is a British actor, or was a British actor because he passed away, and he was most famous in the 1980s for a fantastic cult classic TV show called Manimal. That actor's name is Simon McCorkindale. Have you guys heard of him?
No.
They should have kept his actual name and made him the captain, like Captain McCorkindale. Should have been the first Federation captain. That should have been the first Earth captain right there.
And when
that's
I grew
a great
up,
name. Yeah, I've actually never heard about him actually going up for this role, but McCorkindale, like, that is way better than Archer. Like, that's amazing.
You've definitely seen him before on TV, and I'm a child of the 80s, so I kind of grew up with seeing a lot of his performances. He's been on shows like The Dukes of Hazzard, Fantasy Island. I'm sure he was on Love Boat if he was on those two shows. Heart to Heart, Dynasty. And then he's in one of my all-time favorite cult classic movies called The Sword and the Sorcerer. So if you Googled him, or if any of the listeners want to Google him, you'll be like, oh, that guy. I remember that guy. And he's a very distinguished actor. He has a very interesting, British, polished, poised kind of way about him. But maybe that wasn't what they needed for Archer, because Simon always came off as being very experienced. And I think what they were looking for with Archer was someone who was kind of fumbling, because you don't want an experienced captain out there. You want somebody who's struggling, because, again, as we said in our previous show, how can you prepare for what's out there in deep space? You can't. You know, you can't be like, oh, of course I knew that was going to happen, because that's just really unrealistic. But I'm glad that you guys haven't heard of him, because he was fantastic in the 1980s and 1990s, and he may have been a little too old for the part of Archer, but he was a very distinguished actor, and I'm sure a lot of the listeners will be like, oh, let me Google this guy and see what's going on, and they'll probably be like, yeah, he may have been a little bit too far past the role.
So here's my question. If he was going for the role, was Archer always supposed to be, know, American, the son of Henry Archer, or if they were going to hire him, were they going to rewrite the role around him and his natural background as an actor? You know, British, more seasoned. I don't know. I mean, that's interesting. Would he have, you know, attempted to kind of mold himself into what they wanted Archer to be, or would it be the reverse, that they would mold the role after him?
I would think that they already had the vision of Archer in mind, and right, he is an actor of a certain caliber that knows how to mask his accent, or he would have had a dialogue coach to help with that. I don't know, Tommy, what do you think? That's a pretty cool question, huh?
I think that honestly, they probably just would have rewritten it in terms, because it wouldn't have changed that the character that much to have him be of British descent. So I think, and that's usually the better choice than to have somebody try to mask their accent.
And not as crazy as a British man trying to be French, right?
Is that a reference to something?
It's Captain Picard.
Picard.
Right? Oh, no,
Patrick
I get
Stewart
what you're saying.
Oh, yeah. It still cracks me up how, like, it's like the most English Frenchman possible. It just cracks me up.
You know, the funny thing is, I never even gave it a thought. That's why when you said that, I was like, what do you mean?
Huh?
I guess.
Like, does he ever speak French? I don't think I've ever seen him speak French.
You know the thing? The guy is just so incredible that, like, I just assumed that, like, he probably spoke every language known. So
that's also probably true.
And, you know, the whole thing, it's like 24th century. Sure, why not British Frenchman? But
well, that would have been if we cast Simon, that would have had two Brits.
That's true.
on the bridge, and that would have been kind of interesting too. And we all know the proud tradition of the British heraldry in the Royal Navy, so that could have made sense, you know, with the archer always having served in some capacity or another in the Navy.
Yeah, I mean, that would have changed the character a lot for sure. If he had always been like, you know, come from this long line of Navy people, and he was like this staunch Navy man, you know. I definitely prefer the archer that we had, the much more green archer.
Speaking of green, because I love forcing segues into my show.
Oh, that was too perfect.
I know, right? Colonel Green was a very iconic villain in the original series, and they were thinking about bringing him into Enterprise. And would you believe that Peter Weller was considered for this particular character before they changed him, this character, to John Frederick Paxton?
I'd believe it. I could definitely see him playing that role. And he did just as good a job as Paxton, too. And I like the way they wrote that as Colonel Green being an inspiration for Paxton. I thought that made a lot of sense. And it probably fit the timeline a little better as well.
Well, the disciple, the sensibility is the same. So the motivation for acting is pretty much the same, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think this one is definitely an easy fit. I mean, it speaks volumes that, you know, Peter Weller was Admiral Marcus in Into Darkness. You know, he's playing this villain role. And I think it's funny because, you know, the role he's most known for is Alex Murphy as RoboCop. But it seems like all the work he's been doing lately is, you know, villains, right? So he was a villain in 24. He was a villain in Into Darkness. He was a villain here in Terra Prime and Demons. You know, he's really good at it, obviously. He has, you know, he just seems like someone you don't want to mess with, right? Get on his bad side. So I think this is something that I could definitely see. I will say, though, that watching Terra Prime and Demons, when you see Paxton watching that video clip of Colonel Green, the actor who they have playing Green in that video looks really, you know, looks a lot like, you know, the version of Green in The Savage Curtain, like his facial structure, his ears, like they clearly, Manny Cotto was like, man, we should find some guy that looks like a younger version or somehow related to Green. I mean, obviously that continuity branch is what he was aiming for, but I always thought that was one of those really cool continuity moments where only obsessive fans would really understand and appreciate how similar their faces looked, right? In a definite nod to the old TOS episode.
Now, it's hard to do this after the fact, and I love like all the characters that you know, and all of the casting choices in Enterprise now, because I'm used to it and I know the characters pretty I guess intimately in a way, because I've watched them so many times, and that happens over the course of watching a series and falling in love with a series. But are there any choices that you still feel could have been different? Or do you see an actor now that could have been, you know what, 10 years ago I would have cast him as Reed or as Travis or as Trip? Or do you think they made the right choices at the time? I know hindsight is 20/20 and it's really hard to kind of retcon that, but anything stick out to you that you feel like you still would like to change?
Samuel L. Jackson is Travis. Just saying.
Are you telling me that there are MF and snakes on my MF and Warp 5 ship?
Exactly.
Talk about just...
And when he's talking to the guys who don't like to watch people eat, you know, Travis is the only one on the bridge and they come on the view screen. And Travis says to the English mother effer, do you speak it?
That's true. I feel like that'd be the classic role of just, he's just doing the show a favor. It's just like, I'm just, you know who I am, and I'm just going to play. I mean, obviously, it's, I mean, we've discussed it on the show before. It's really unfortunate that Travis didn't really have much to do, but it would have been hilarious in hindsight that they had an actor like Samuel L. Jackson, and they still treated him like they treated Anthony Montgomery in actual Enterprise. Like, they literally didn't do anything with him. He's just sitting there like, yep, impulse speed. Got it, Captain. Like, nothing else changes.
I tell you what, I would totally Kickstarter or like a remastered version of Travis's scenes if they could have Samuel L. Jackson hang upside down in the sweet spot.
It would be like the easiest paycheck. He would literally like phone it in, just like, yep, I'm just here, sitting here. Yeah.
The great thing about Samuel L. Jackson phoning it in is it's still awesome.
It is, yeah. That's not taking anything away, exactly.
So would that mean that in Inner Mirror Dark Leads Part 1 and 2 that we would have Travis with an eye patch?
What? Because that would be pretty cool. This? That would be.
That's true. But I will say that I was a big fan of Travis's high top fade in Into Mirror Darkly.
No, that was a really
nice
touch.
That is a great look. I was like, man, that is Fresh Prince status. That's bringing it back. Like, that was a good look.
You know what that was? That was his goatee moment. Just like true. Cisco.
Or when Saval, Cisco, who has a goatee and is a science crewman, randomly, like, hey, okay. Like, okay.
Well, Vulcans always have goatees in the mirror universe. That's like a law or something like that. Is it because it's like illogical to have facial hair in the Prime universe?
Good question.
Will, write that down. That is a definite topic for conversation. Vulcan facial hair in the Prime universe versus facial hair in the mirror universe.
That's actually a good point. I don't think we've ever seen one in the Prime universe that has facial hair, have we?
No. Mm-mm. Because I think it's illogical for them to have that. There's no reason for it. Right? I mean, it's not like they'd have a soup catcher or something like that.
Well, I mean, if we're going to go with that logic, what's the point of hair in general?
Well, yeah. Well, I'm surprised that Vulcans aren't bald.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, this one on a tangent.
Some kind of diplomatic statement. I don't know.
All Vulcans have to have bowl cuts, right? Like, that's clearly, like, that's another thing. Like, they all have to have the same haircut. It just gets to me. Like, I just can't.
I tell you what, a really not good paying job in that universe is being a Vulcan barber. I would like the number one cut, please. I would like the number one cut, please.
In keeping with the Lower Decks, the Vulcan barber, you know, that could be the recurring character.
What was the name of the barber on the Next Generation? Because
he was the Bullion, right?
Mr. Mott.
That's
Mr.
right.
Mr. Mott. Yeah.
Mr. Mott.
And everyone talked to him. He would have been a great Lower Decks type of character. Yeah. You're right. Yeah.
See, actually, again, I'm going on another tangent here, but we've never really seen, you know, like, I hate to use the word, but like an underachieving Vulcan, right? Vulcans are science officers, they're engineers, right? But like, what do you do with Vulcans? I just want to hang out and just like, I don't want to be in the science academy. I don't want
aren't
to join
Starfleet.
Aren't they
called Romulans? No, I'm just kidding.
What was that?
Yeah. So aren't they called Romulans?
No, but Romulans are but they're like the opposite. But like, they're also super talented and devious, and they're like generals and proconsuls and
senators. They just kill everyone.
Just like a Vulcan that just like, yeah, I just want to hang out. I want to be a barber. I want to be a bartender. Like, you don't see that, right? I just think it's so interesting.
Okay, so
they all have to be like the best of the best, or they're really good at science. It's just like, are
I'm gonna
all
throw
of them
this.
Good? I don't know.
I'm going to throw this into the next subspace postcard because Nathaniel Canner asked us speculation on plot points that have been explored in future seasons if the show hadn't been canceled. And I know that we're making light of this about kind of like the average Vulcan, but there were those Vulcans out there, like in the episode where T'Pol was forced into the mind meld, and they weren't the science Vulcans, they weren't the officer Vulcans.
Yeah,
they
that's
were
a good point.
Like,
actually, yeah,
they were going out there and becoming explorers of the universe, i.e., expanding their minds through the Vulcan mind meld, which was pretty much an outlawed practice and a deviant art in the eyes of the Vulcan High Command. So you actually have them out there. They're not, you know, they're not of the science officer type. So would it be possible if we ran into that ilk again? And what would you do?
You know,
what would T'Pol do? Because T'Pol was violated by that sect, if you will.
It all comes back to the Lower Decks. Once again, we only tend to see in TV show like the few mains that make everything happen. And I think that's really unfortunate because there's a lot of potential in all of these alien societies. And in the case of the Lower Decks of the Enterprise crew, to see different parts of to see the goings on in these different parts of their societies that we don't ever get to see. And I wish like some Star Trek show at some point, doesn't even have to be Enterprise, would have done a little more with that. What do the people who aren't the top tier on Vulcan do? What I mean, do they even have artists? I mean, obviously they do, but that's not very logical. So
yeah,
it would be nice to see that.
There's a very potential dark. There are very potentially dark implications of a very strict, quote unquote, meritocracy or a pursuit of logic to the exclusion of everything else. So, you know, if you don't meet with the expectations of that society, if you don't fit a need that they need, you know, there's some dark implications in terms of, do they just cast aside these people? Are they just considered an undesired, you know, cast of people? Do they, are they viewed differently if they're just not a productive member of Vulcan society and they're not doing all these noble grand things, right? Like, it's very interesting. And, you know, you could extrapolate that to Starfleet too. I mean, you see the same in Next Generation. I feel like it's ramped up to its zenith in terms of Enterprise is the best and the brightest, right? Everyone is at top of their game. Everyone wants to be there. But like, what if you're just average, not quote unquote, like quote unquote average, right? How do you survive in that universe, and let alone on Starfleet? How do you, are you just an average officer? Like, how does that work?
Are these the ships that get destroyed during the Dominion War?
It's very true. They absolutely get destroyed.
Or Wolf 359.
Wolf 359. No, but it's an interesting point because we don't get a chance to see who aren't the best and the brightest. Now, let's take it to Star Trek the Motion Picture when Spock refuses to finish Cullinor. What happens? I mean, is he completely rejected by the Vulcan Science Academy? I mean, it's okay for him to go back to Starfleet, but is that, in their eyes, a lesser pursuit because he didn't finish purging the entirety of emotion from his being, the Cullinor process?
I feel like probably, because Sarek totally chewed out Spock for joining Starfleet, right? As opposed to the Science Academy. So even if, I feel like if he is giving him the third degree on that, if he doesn't even finish Cullinor, like, I feel like that would definitely put him on, you know, Sarek's bad side, right?
Well, I mean, it's one of those things where it's, well, sadly, we'll never see something like that, but
yeah.
But it's just an interesting thing. I agree with Tommy, what you're saying, that it's probably off-putting to fans sometimes when you only get to see the best and the brightest, and you don't get to see just kind of like the normal crewman who goes about his day-to-day routine, brushes his teeth, goes to his duty station, does a pretty good job, maybe gets chewed out by a supervisor. I mean, is that what we have possibly have seen on the Columbia? Because the Columbia was another...
Oh, look at that segue.
Thank you. Did you like that? That was pretty smooth.
That was just... I didn't see that one coming. So that was good.
But no, so like going into the Columbia has a pretty green crew as well. They could probably read the captain's logs or the logs of the superior officers, you know, like Tripp and T'Pol and Reed for their counterparts on the Columbia. But there's, for all intents and purposes, they're new. So what happens there? Is that an interesting storyline to follow?
Probably not. It probably just, I mean, in terms of what the writers would have chosen, they probably wouldn't have. It probably would have just been pushed aside like the lower decks of the Enterprise crew. And when you think about how it was handled, the bridge crew of the NX-01, they were all newbies too when they started. But I just don't really know what I'm trying to say. I just don't think they would have really focused on it that much with Columbia.
Yeah, I think with Columbia, there's two things. There's a serious point to be made, and there's a funny point to be made. I think the funny point to be made is it'd be hilarious if the entire crew of the NX-02 were literally the second choices for all the spots in the NX-01. Like, they're literally the runner-ups from captain on down to crewman. It's all the ones that didn't make an NX-01. So they're literally... like the second string, like the B team in every definition.
The NX-02 is the ship, the also-rans,
yeah,
if you will. You know, but you know what, that's, and it, as funny as that is, it's not
there's
necessarily
a serious point
untrue.
To that. Exactly.
You know, yeah. I mean, yeah, why not have the second best? Because that second best, it's still first place in someone's mind, right? You know, it's
that's the motto on their patch.
Number two is still still first place in some.
It's just a guy. It's just a person on a second pedestal, just like somewhere we're first place.
Well, it's not the NX-01, it's the NX-02.
Oh, man, that's...
I think really, though, the Columbia would have been the type of episode appearance where it would just be the bailout episode. Like, we need help bringing the NX-02, or vice versa. The NX-02 has gone off into uncharted space. They're doing their mission, and the Enterprise is somewhat close by, so they need a helping hand, or they need to join forces and create, like, a giant stable warp field and have people move back and forth. No, wait, they've done that already. So
I love how in the few scenes you see the NX-02, like the only difference between the bridge and the NX-01 is on the side of Hernandez.
Conduits.
There's those two pillars that just glow, like they have the light pulse. Like, what role does that play? You know what I'm talking about, Tommy?
Oh yeah,
it plays the role at the end of These Are the Voyages.
Exactly. They put that in the future NX-01. Like, what does this huge pillar do? Like, I don't get it. Like, how is this an evolution?
In fact, when I was modeling the bridge for the NX-04 Discovery and Horizon, I considered whether or not I should put those in because they were on the NX-02. But then I thought, you know, they really are just there to make the bridge look slightly different. There's no possible purpose they could serve.
What if they just extrapolated that in every deck of the NX-02, there's just a random pillar in the hallway that just flashes a light?
I was believing that it had something to do with structural integrity and boosting the dampening field, but forget you guys. You guys are
wow,
ruining all of
it. That's an excellent TNG explanation.
I actually thought it was warp plasma because you would totally want to route that through the back of the bridge in plain sight, but yeah.
Well, of course you do. You know, but that means that if you have extra warp plasma injectors, you would need another engineer on the bridge to make sure that they're always aligned.
Well, there is an engineering station on the bridge that rarely gets used. So
that's true. Tommy, you solved it all.
See, I'm a writer. This is what I do.
So what about, say, let's go back to the unexplored plot points and look at a little bit at where we were headed with the Romulan War, especially with like the Babel arc, because I know some people didn't like the whole drone thing, but I thought that was a really interesting plot device where the Romulans are out there, they're using the drone because they obviously don't want to dirty their hands. They're making it look like all these other ships are attacking all these other allies or vice versa. And they're starting to fear what's happening with all the other races. And I thought that they were doing a good job with it, and obviously we're not going to get it, but season 5 has always kind of been hinted towards the Romulan War, and the season 5 Enterprise campaign on Facebook kind of is trending that way with the refit of the NX-01 and the movement towards the Romulan War. So that seems like a logical progression from season 4, don't you think? I think Manny Kota would have been able to drive it that way pretty well.
Yeah, I think so. The only thing is the time frame. I mean, because These Are the Voyages took place pretty much probably like a year, give or take, after the end of the Romulan War. And Demons in Terra Prime was about 10 years before that episode. So you have like this 10-year gap that you'd have to jump, give or take. And so I mentioned this once with Chris on Warp 5, that I think what would have been really interesting is if they encountered some sort of anomaly or temporal vortex and the ship was sucked, you know, 5 or so years into the future, and then the show just continues on from there and they never get that 5 years back. It's like a kind of a reset for season 5 where you can jump into the middle of the Romulan War, because realistically, with only 3 seasons left, there's no way they could have covered the whole war. So they would have had to do something. They would have had to skip some time.
Well, Will, you're a Battlestar Galactica fan, right? And the fans pretty much, I remember that happened at the end of season 1 to season 2, and the fans pretty much swallowed that hook, line, and sinker that the surrender of the Colonial Fleet to the camps was 1 year.
Yeah,
you know,
I think that's right.
Where Baltar took his presidency, because it literally
was it a year fast forward?
I think it was. It was like on screen. The subtitle said like 1 year later, and yeah. I'm sitting there. I'm like, how do you jump 12 months? like, and have people buy that storytelling wise.
They did that too, though, in Alias. I mean, there's like seasons two or three or something like that. They just jumped two or three years into the future. And it worked with Battlestar too, because it provides you this way where you can essentially reset everything. And it gives you all these new stories to tell of trying to figure out, oh, how did we get from where we were to where we are now?
Are you saying it's been a long road getting from there to here?
It has.
Oh, that was set up perfectly. Just like Tommy just like pitched it low ball and just like Norm's like going to point where the ball is going to go and just knocked it right
out. I totally did that on purpose,
the Segway show.
But no, that's actually a really good, that's a good point, Tommy. And, you know, ironically enough, I was just thinking that type of narrative storytelling is what could make a season five work now if it was to go back on Netflix. Obviously the actors have aged, obviously time has passed, so they could do that type of jump and say it's been, you know, 8-10 years of brutal wars with Romulans. It has taken its toll on this crew. This is where they are now. Archer, Scott Bakula clearly looks different. He's aged. It would make sense that, you know, he could be an admiral at this point, and other people have progressed as well. So I think that's becoming more and more of a common storytelling device, and it makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, and at this point, they wouldn't even need like a setup just because it's been so long. I mean, you wouldn't need a temporal vortex or whatever. It's just, you know, this takes place more or less real time after where the show ended.
No, you probably need a slingshot around the sun.
That's true. Times.
Well, you have to fit time travel. I mean, it's a Star Trek, for Pete's sake. You have to have some type of like unexplainable temporal issue.
Chronoton particles or the orb of time. All three, actually, would probably make sense, too.
Well, calm down, Will. It's a little bit of snow madness it's the ice balls have gotten to his brain.
And see, then we can retcon the universe. You know, once you combine the orb of time, the slingshot around the sun, and the chronoton particles, somehow it goes back and everything explodes, and then you have the Big Bang, and then boom, we've just created the universe.
What about red matter? Did I just blow your mind?
You did. Red, yeah, that's true. That was the fourth part of the equation. That's what created the singularity of the Big Bang. See, there we go.
One little red dot.
I love how in Star Trek, we've just listed four separate ways to travel in time.
Yes.
That's how often they do it.
I'm sure we're missing a couple. That's also true. That's what we love about Star Trek. So one last subspace postcard to wrap it up. And we have Aaron Harvey on the Babel Conference asking us to talk about set industrial graphic designs on the show. And I'm going to turn this over a bit to Tommy because he's our resident expert on actually personally studying set design, costume design, production design for Horizon. And you said on previous Warp 5s, Tommy, that you've actually been your own architect and seamstress and writer and production designer. So how do you approach something like this from trying to emulate what you saw on screen, which is a certain era, the 2151 era, and trying to extrapolate that in your time frame? It's the same time frame, but I'm saying in your particular story, and making sure everything looks consistent to the scrutinizing eye of a fan.
Well, first off, I want to say that I'm all for gender neutral terminology. I don't think seamstress is gender neutral, but I think
how about
tailor would be, but I'm okay with seamstress too.
Plain, simple tailor.
Huh? Yeah. Yeah,
tailor sounds good.
Or the quartermaster, the Starfleet quartermaster.
That's a good one.
Also to be found in the next Lower Decks episode of Enterprise.
Yes, exactly. Because they did mention the quartermaster a couple of times, but that we never saw or heard of him or her. But set design, Enterprise, was really good. I think it's some of the best set design they did. They had, you know, four shows before that to learn from, and it made the best use of the space they had. The way they did the corridors, for example, my biggest pet peeve, hands down, with the three shows that immediately preceded Enterprise, you could always tell where they were in the set, because because Voyager was built on top of the TNG sets, essentially.
Now, when you're saying preceded, that would be Next Generation, Deep Space Nine, and Voyager.
Right, correct. Okay. And for instance, in Voyager and TNG, it was always that curve of a hallway, and then there was a straight section at the center of the curve, or at the top of the curve, and down that corridor, you had the transporter room, and you had the turbo lift. And if you kept going around the curve, you had, you know, the cargo bay or the holodeck, which was either or. And so what I loved about Enterprise with their set design is they made the corridors, they built them in such a way where they could have actors walk around them in different routes where it actually looked like they were on a different deck. It wasn't always the same path of corridor. And I thought that was a brilliant piece of set design. And just the amount of detail that went into it. I've talked about this on the show before, where it's even things like little stickers with the part number for the piece of bulkhead that's on like every single bulkhead on the set.
Almost like a QC code or some type of...
Yeah, I mean, like UPC. This is one of the things I replicated for my CG set. It's this sticker, and it has like a part number, and it has like a more specific number below it, so you can identify specifically each bulkhead and probably where it was produced in Starfleet, in like which yard made it or whatever. Just little stuff like that that made the sets so well made. And of course, a lot of them were both very unique and pulled from other Star Treks a lot too. The bridge was very much harkened back to TOS, where you had the offset turbo lift in the corner, and mm-hmm. you had the helm and the captain's chair on their own platform in the center, and the ready room had the angled bulkheads. It was all of that stuff that was really pulled inspiration from the original series that made it look like, you know, maybe this could be Captain Kirk's Enterprise in the future.
Well, it's one of the things that I know that fans had an issue with when they first saw Enterprise was coming to grips with making that mental bridge between the Doug Drexler / Herman Zimmerman style of design on Enterprise and the Matt Jeffries design on the original series. And remember, what they did on Enterprise was done in 2000 in production. What they did on the original series was done in 1965, 1966 production.
Yeah. And there's no way you can make that jump. You just can't.
Exactly. Exactly. And now, I know there are probably some listeners saying that, well, that's being disrespectful. But come on. You have to really look at it from the logic of production and say, and realistically agree with, that this style is emulating what NASA was,
right,
moving forward. Not this romanticized version of futuristic design, but this practical evolution of production design. And that's where kind of like this disagreement,
right,
quote unquote, to say it nicely, is happening with the fans, especially when they saw it for the first time on the show back
in
2001.
It's probably one of the biggest sticking points for people accepting Enterprise. I think for me, it took me a little bit of some thinking for me to reconcile the two, because I think a lot of fans have that very initial visceral reaction. And, you know, Christopher Jones put it best, you know, the best way to enjoy Enterprise, if you just enjoy it on its own merits, and once you enjoy it on its own merits, you can then begin to tie it into the larger Trek universe, how it ties into TOS. But if you come at it from such a baggaged perspective, then it's tough for people to reconcile sometimes.
The problem is it's just the nature of things. Like, TNG still looks pretty good, but in comparison to JJ Trek looks much more quote unquote futuristic.
Oh, absolutely.
And
yeah.
it's just the natural progression of things. And I think Enterprise, they did a really good job imitating architecturally the style of Matt Jeffries, because in watching this show so many times and really studying it, even down to a lot of the buttons on the consoles and the computer displays are directly inspired from the original series. They have like these slider graph thingies that are on their computer displays. And
yeah, Travis's, right? There's a big
There's that, but there's also like a digital version. It's a computer, like it's just something you see on a monitor. and it's almost exactly right. a copy of something you would see on the screens in TOS Enterprise. And so it's the little things like that that they pulled over from the original series, but they couldn't realistically take everything. And because it's just not the 1960s, there's no way around that. You look at the Lost in Space movie. They took things from the original series and they updated it for the movie, like using the original Jupiter 2 as the outer shell for the new Jupiter 2, which I thought was really cool. But realistically, you cannot take that 1960s Jupiter 2 and make it work today. It doesn't completely carry over. And so there's some sacrifices that you have to make.
Well, another jarring difference between Enterprise and then the original series and moving forward was the choice of uniform design. Now, Will, one of the cool pictures that I've seen from you on Facebook is you in your formal Next Generation uniform.
When
I looked at that, I was like, the piping looks really interesting on that. And then it just dawned on me that the formal piping, at least the shoulder up, is exactly what they used on the Enterprise uniform. Just that one strand of piping from the deltoid around the front of the chest and back. And I was like, wow, I didn't really notice that before, but that was an interesting kind of throwback from all the way into the Next Generation, all the way back, you know, to 2151 on those, basically those jumpsuits, those NASA style jumpsuits. So I thought that was a really interesting design through line from the past, well, actually the future to the past. So Tommy, when you were researching how to create these uniforms, what was the most difficult thing that was your challenge to try and make sure that they looked screen authentic to the TV show?
It would be the shoulders, actually.
Well, what just talked
yeah,
about?
Yeah, and that's the one thing that makes the uniform not realistic, I think, because it's way too complicated to make the uniform easily mass producible for a government organization that would be something like a military or exploration service like Starfleet is. When you think about like what your average military person today wears, it's much more simplistic. And the problem is the shoulders are very custom tailored, and it's difficult because those stripes are it's about a third of an inch, I believe, thick, and they don't sit on top of the fabric. Well, there's three layers. You have the base jumpsuit layer, that's the base fabric. And then you put your stripe on, and then you put another layer on top of that. So it's not just a stripe that's sitting on top of everything. It's actually covered by a third layer. And that all goes into the seam. And so when you're sewing the front and back together and the sides of the sleeves together, you have to line up the stripes exactly perfectly, and they have to be the exact same dimensions on the front and back. Otherwise, you're going to have one side of your arm with a larger stripe and the other side of your arm with a smaller stripe, and the same for the top of the shoulders. And so it's the kind of thing that's very custom tailored, and still, even after 11 uniforms, whenever I make one, I have to sew the shoulder, and I wind up ripping it out probably at least 5 to 10 times before I get it just spot on, accurate. And I'm sure, like, if I was a professional tailor, quote-unquote, that would be, I'd get a lot better at that, but it's the kind of thing that's just very time consuming. And it looks nice, but it's also the reason why one of the main reasons I chose not to go with any of the online options for uniforms, because nobody got that right. They just took like a big piece of gold fabric and sewed it on top of everything. Which,
when you say online, do you mean like the cosplay vendors on eBay?
Yeah. And that looks terrible when you just take like a big gold piece of fabric and sew it on top of everything, which is why I understand why they did it the way they did in Enterprise, because it looks really nice to fold everything into the seams and what have you. And the other big challenge was all the zippers. There's 13 zippers on one uniform, and that is really time consuming to sew all those zippers.
Do you think that they've actually justified on screen using every single pouch on that uniform? I've only seen really used for two.
Yeah, I don't think that, honestly, they have used all of them. And the strange thing is, some pockets have two zippers. Like,
Who they're called auxiliary zippers. Yeah. They're it's redundant.
But if your main zipper doesn't hold, the auxiliary zipper
right. I mean, like, yeah. I actually know why they did it. On, like, for instance, on the left hip pocket, they have one on the inside of the hip facing your right leg, and they have one on the outside of the hip facing away from you. And I think that's so you can open the outside one and put your hands in your pockets. Now, what I would have done was I just would have put that outside one on there and not even had the interior one. That's just me. And that's, once again, the kind of thing that I think from, like, a military production perspective, they probably would not have put, you know, two zippers on one pocket. And, you know, for instance, like, the top pocket on the top right is really deep, but the zipper is quite small. So there's no way you'd be able to really get your whole hand and arm down in there if you put something small in there. So it's little things like that, but they do look really nice.
That's really fascinating, Tommy. I would have never realized all those details that you just mentioned, you know, obviously from watching the show. How did you learn all of this? Was it trial and error, or did you at all have a chance to interact with some of the production designers or someone that actually made the particular Enterprise uniform? Because I feel like with the Enterprise uniforms, they're still not as well known or recognizable as the TNG or the TOS uniforms, and they're so different in design. So was there someone that really, that you could be a like, that was your resource, that knew all these ins and outs?
Well, there's a forum called the 1701 First, like the 1701st, or I don't even think you could say that technically, but and there's a guy in there who basically did a trial and error process of making his own uniform. And I don't know if he's a professional tailor, but he's clearly quite good, and he documented the whole process. And so I was able to follow along with that pretty closely, and it was incredibly helpful because he had tons of close-up pictures, and he contacted some people who had screen-used uniforms, and he posted really close-up pictures of those, which was very helpful. And it's one of the things that made me sewing an Enterprise uniform as the first thing I ever sewed a lot easier. But in terms of, like, actual production staff, like, I never talked to that guy or anyone from the production staff. I just kind of trial and errored my way through the whole thing. And that's why the first two uniforms were absolutely terrible. And it's why the captain's was the fourth uniform that I sewed. And it did not fit him well at all, below the belt, if you know what I mean. He was very uncomfortable. And so I had to make him one, and that a second one, and that wound up being the fifth uniform. So there was definitely a long process of figuring things out before I finally was able to get my own process down.
You know, one of the last things I wanted to talk about in terms of design from the Enterprise era to the original series era is the progression of ship to tail. And I have a theory about this, and actually the Axanar short film, Prelude to Axanar, illustrates this in a little bit of a manner. There is an obvious different look between the Doug Drexler NX-01 and the original series Matt Jeffries ship. But when you take a look at what's happening in J.J. Abrams' movie and in Prelude to Axanar, there is kind of like a hybridization of what's happening there in terms of just the superstructure and the way that the textures are being used and being mapped on the ship. And in the history of Axanar, Alec Peters and Christian Gossett wrote a section of the history dealing with the Arcanus campaign. And in the Arcanus campaign, a majority of Starfleet ships were destroyed. I believe it was 17. So somewhere along the line, that design style of ship was obviously torn apart and studied and improved upon and redesigned, and the next phase of ships had to be created, which would be the Ares class, the type of ship that would be able to take on the D6 in war. And you start seeing a hybridization of design from the Drexler style to the Jeffries style. You're seeing less panel work, you're seeing more smooth hulls, but the nacelles are still somewhat similar. And then finally, when you start getting towards the end of the 4 years war, the ships are starting to trend more towards the Constitution class, because that's one of the pinnacle story moments as seen in Prelude to Axanar, and you're getting closer to the Jeffries style. So I thought that was a really neat, very respectful way of trying to bridge the design continuity between the Enterprise that you saw in, say, like A Mirror Darkly, sharing the same space with or at least the same screen time at in terms of the editing as the Defiant, which is a Constitution class ship from the 1960s era. To me, that makes a little bit more sense than just jumping from 150 years of this look to the look of the TOS ship. And I thought that the fans may want to take a look at that when it comes to trying to at least make a little bit of sense when it comes to the design jump between such huge contrasts of style.
I just want to, like, just my quick little soapbox. I think fans, or people in general, would find that their lives would be much easier and much less stressful if they just assumed that everything in the original series looked at least like the motion picture. Like, just erase what the original series actually looks like in your mind and assume that it at least looks like the motion picture. And everything could...
Or accept the J.J. style more?
Well, possibly? That, but I mean, like, at least, like, with the motion picture, you started to have a more realistic take on the Enterprise. You know, yeah. You didn't have the really skinny nacelle pylons that were completely unrealistic. The hull wasn't completely smooth. There was detail. And, of course, these are things, you know, the smooth hull was a budgetary concern, et cetera, which is why I think it's just easier to suspend your disbelief in your mind and say, and not try to cross this gap between a very high budget TV show like Enterprise to an incredibly low budget cardboard sets TV show, 1960s TV show like the original series. It's just storyline wise, it's the approach that they should have that they originally took with the Klingons. Obviously, everybody knew it was a makeup change, and we just didn't talk about it. You just pretended that they had ridges when you watched the show, until Enterprise very cleverly covered that topic, and I think that's much easier to do than retconning the designs of the ships. But that's just my opinion, and I'm sure a lot of people will hate me for it. But
no, I think that's a valid point, and you know what? I would actually like to expound on that point a little bit more in a full episode, because there are situations where we're going to have very strong opinions about fans never wanting to see any change in a certain way, and other fans saying that the only way for the series or the genre of Star Trek to survive is to change. Obviously, that hot button was probably no more present than in JJ's 2009, and even more so in Into Darkness, when they were emulating more of the Star Trek, well, Star Trek II: The Wrath of Khan. I mean, let's be honest about it. So, but
I'm just gonna.
Yeah, I mean, go ahead, Will.
I just want to interject one thing is, I think it's really ironic that you see a lot of fan productions and a lot of fan films. A lot of them have, I think, far and away, TOS is the one that's replicated the most. New Voyages, Phase 2, Star Trek Continues. Obviously, that comes from a place of nostalgia for the original series, and it started everything else. But there's also a part of me that realizes the reason why those fans use TOS and the bridge sets and the original Enterprise as a setting is because it's a lot easier to replicate that bridge and that setting, because it's a lot simpler to build, because back then it was a simple construction. Those buttons were simpler. They were, a lot of them were cardboard. A lot of them were things that can be quote unquote done on an amateur level. That's why you don't see a fan film TNG bridge. You don't see, you know, I mean, that's why what you're doing, Tommy, is so impressive. A fan film
or
Enterprise, right?
You know, or Deep Space Nine Promenade.
Or Deep Space Nine, exactly. So, you know, it's a combination of nostalgia. I get that. I don't want to take that away from those productions. But at the same time, it's so much easier from a production standpoint to recreate the TOS bridge than, you know, the Defiant, the USS Defiant, or the NCC, the Galaxy class, the D, right? It's just so much easier.
And the same with every other part of the ship, too, from the corridors to engineering to sickbay.
Yeah.
It's just so much simpler.
Yeah, so I think a lot of people, it's a, you know, you're right, Tommy. I think people just really have to find that balance where they only can take it up to a certain point. You know what I mean? You know, there's fun to be had in terms of, you know, filling in gaps, but at a certain point, like, you can only do so much, right?
And I think this is why, like, it's the one complaint you don't usually hear about JJ. Like, a lot of people complain about JJ, but I don't usually hear complaints about it doesn't look like Star Trek technology, because everybody knows that it's an update, it's a reboot, they change things for present day. And we accept that for what it is. And, you know, honestly, it's probably an unpopular choice, but if I was the one making, like, a movie out of Intermirror Darkly, I probably would have updated the Constitution class a little bit.
Ooh, that's a bold opinion there, Tommy.
Because I know it is, but it just, they did a good job with the lighting, admittedly, making it look a little bit more modern. But
well, that's our next show, by the way. We got to do that show. No, it's a great topic for conversation.
Yeah, I agree. And yeah, you know, I could talk about this endlessly. So in the interest of time, I will let it go. I'll get off my soapbox.
No, let's bookmark that because I really do think that that's an important thing to talk about. And why wouldn't they have made that choice? Because I know Manny Kota wanted to respect the fans, but it would have also been a really interesting decision to have at least upgraded it in some fashion just to maybe fit it into the Enterprise universe a little bit more, but that could have really burned a lot of bridges there.
Yeah, so, I mean, it might not have worked on the TV show, but I think if it were a standalone movie, it would be a much more acceptable choice.
Bookmark that. Yeah, yeah. We're definitely going to talk about that later on. So, But thank you, everyone, for sending in your subspace postcards. And I'm sorry that we weren't able to get to all of them, but I assure you that there are still great ideas out there that we'd like to talk about, and we will definitely get to them in future episodes. But before we go, I would like to take a little bit of time here just to acknowledge and pay respect to one of the greatest figures, not only in Star Trek, but in science fiction history. And that is Leonard Nimoy and his character, Mr. Spock, who are, in some people's minds, one and the same and interchangeable. In the minds and hearts of the fans, he is a legend to us, if not a great source of inspiration and just very important humanitarian greatness. I'm not even sure how I can keep throwing on more positive adjectives to describe Leonard Nimoy. So I'm going to let Will and Tommy and I just take a moment and express how we feel about Leonard, because to me, I just can't imagine a world of Star Trek without him. And I'm not going to belabor the point because I know that in other Trek FM broadcasts, Christopher Jones is probably going to do this at length. But if I could sum up my feelings about Leonard Nimoy, it would be his famous quote. And it would be, "I have been and always shall be your friend." And for my feeling towards him is like, I have been and always shall be your fan. And that's about as much as I can say about that without just taking this to a completely different personal level.
Yeah, I think for me, what I was thinking about earlier today, and it's been a lot to process. I actually found out when I got back from lunch, my boss told me directly, you know, he said, "Condolences." I said, "Condolences for what?" He said, "Didn't you hear? You know, Leonard Nimoy passed." And, you know, when I went online, you know, my newsfeed was just exploding, and it still is exploding hours after the fact. And it's, you know, it's still taking time for me to process. But as I was thinking about it earlier today, I literally can't think of another character in Star Trek, even more than Kirk, even more than Picard. Spock is really the most identifiable character in and outside of Star Trek fandom. You know, my mother-in-law knows Live Long and Prosper. She knows the salute. She knows the Vulcan pointy ears. They are the things that you say probably next to, you know, "Beam me up, Scotty," which, you know, that was actually never said in the TV show. But, you know, "Live long and prosper," all of those things are those things that have crossed over into the mainstream consciousness. And when I'm trying to explain Star Trek to someone that knows nothing about Star Trek, you know, those are one of the first things I refer to is "live long and prosper." You know, the Vulcan pointy ears. People understand, like, "Oh, Mr. Spock, I get it." And, you know, he has that outsized influence. And within Trek, I don't think any other character, aside from him, has had an impact across so many iterations, right? So TOS, and then he was Unification in TNG. And then he was in the new reboots. And he has been in every crucial phase, every next generation, if you will, every next iteration. And I think it's just amazing the fact that he's really had such an arc as a character, considering that he wanted his character to die initially in Wrath of Khan, and yet his character has just grown so much since then. So, you know, for me, it's really tough to imagine a world with Star Trek without Leonard Nimoy. And, you know, I think we were always fearing that this day would come, but we never thought it would come. But for me, my line that I will always remember or always will take to heart is Bones' statement to Kirk at the end of Wrath of Khan is, you know, he's really not dead if you remember him. And that's very true. I mean, I think that's probably one of the biggest things you could take away for life in general, is that the things that we love and cherish, as long as we remember them, those people and those things, they'll always be there. So, you know, for me, it's, you know, it's a lot to process.
So it's hard to say anything that hasn't already been said by you guys or by the fandom, or anything that isn't just typical. And I had this problem when I was writing on the Horizon page too, where I wrote, you know, like a brief condolences kind of message. And it's interesting because Captain Kirk's Star Trek and the people in that cast were not the ones that influenced me the most. But typically when celebrities pass away, it doesn't bother me that much. But I found myself like actually choked up, like almost wanting to cry when I heard the news. And, you know, they are these people and these characters that will always be with us and changed a lot of lives. Star Trek has changed my life a lot for the better. And it may not have been the cast of the original series that did that, but it was the cast of the original series that allowed that to happen. And Spock, I mean, Spock has always been one of my favorite characters. And Leonard Nimoy, I think, was a tremendously talented person. He was a really good photographer, and he was a really great actor. Spoiler alert for anybody who's planning on watching Fringe. That's one of the only things extensively I've seen him do other than Spock. And it was tremendous. It was nothing like Spock. It was a great role, and eventually he became the villain in that show. And I've never seen Leonard Nimoy play a villain before. And that he did such a good job at it. And so I don't want to belabor it too much, because I think we have a tendency to there. I guess there's a lot of people that deserve to be missed as well. And I think Spock would be the first one to say we should give equal memory to everyone. And so Leonard Nimoy lived out that character, it seemed to me, as somebody who didn't know him personally, but saw the public image of him. He seemed to live out that character in his real life. And I respect him a lot for that and for the work he did.
One last thought, and just on an upbeat note, if you want to see an awesome episode of TV that has a very young Leonard Nimoy, a very young William Shatner, and Colonel Klink in the exact same episode, watch The Original Man from U.N.C.L.E., Season 1, The Project Strygas Affair. And that will just absolutely lift your spirit, because it's just amazing that they did this before they were even on Star Trek together, which was fantastic. So thank you, Tommy and Will, for your respectful and poignant thoughts on the passing of Leonard Nimoy. We will miss him. He will always forever be in our hearts. And as long as we continue to discuss Star Trek, his memory will live on. It's been simply amazing discussing all of these great topics that have come in for Subspace Postcards here in the conference room. But this isn't the only topic we've been talking about here on Trek FM this past week. So here's a quick look at some of the other things you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
previously on Trek.fm. Standard Orbit.
This episode isn't very good, but...
Are we just going to pin all of our choices?
You pretty much have to. But the thing about this episode, which we talked about a couple weeks ago, I think, is it's a crazy idea.
Earl Grey.
Picard, can you construct a rudimentary lathe?
Go for its weak spot. It's an energy being. It doesn't have a vulnerable spot. Get off the line, the Forge.
The Orb.
Or we could just blame it on Janeway somehow, you know, that she scared the Borg into the Gamma Quadrant because they were tired of dealing with her in the Delta Quadrant. I don't know.
To the journey!
Because this is the dangers, by the way, kids, of having babies in the 24th century. Because if Kathy's first word was coffee and she was standing next to the replicator, the next thing you know, you have a hyped up 2-year-old.
The Ready Room.
Well, it's kind of like, you know, you've got your lucky shirt when you're watching a football game and your team won when you were wearing it. So now you have to wear it every time. That's also the Enterprise insignia. That's the insignia of the only ship whose crew didn't die.
Yeah.
So
just wear
course,
it on the right color shirt. That's all.
That's right.
Commentary, Trek Stars.
And then he turns to her and he says, who is that man that I was just hugging? And she says, that was William Shatner. And he's like, who?
Literary Treks.
Well, you know, I'm really a fan of a lot of, you know, different kinds of, you know, naval fiction. You know, C.S. Forrester, Horatio Hornblower, those novels.
So good.
You know, Patrick O'Brien, you know, the Master and Commander books. You know, these are all things which sort of put me into the right mindset.
The 602 Club.
So when we come kind of to the story here, and especially off of doing Literary Treks where we talk about Michael Piller's book Fade In, kind of got behind the scenes of Insurrection and really seeing how that story changed. To me, it really just exemplified the importance of story in a movie.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
Check out these shows and find out what we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond. You will find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, be sure to hit the subscribe button. That helps us out greatly and makes it easier for other listeners to find the show as they search iTunes. Now, I'd like to take a moment here to read a couple of 5-star reviews that have come in for Warp 5, and I can't even express how grateful we all are here in the conference room to read these, because it's reviews like these that just make our job here even more satisfying, because we love bringing all of this content here at Warp 5 to you. 49er Faithful says, if you are an Enterprise fan or a Star Trek fan curious about Enterprise, I would greatly recommend this podcast. It used to be hosted by Christopher Jones, founder of Trek FM, but since December, Norman C. Lau has become the main host and he's done a great job. The last few episodes have been about introducing the series to newcomers, and the topics of conversations have been excellent, up to the standards of other Trek FM podcasts. The last episode focused on a character who was only in the series for maybe 3 episodes, but made a lasting impact, Kelly Waymire. It's still sad that she passed away so young, but the episode was a very nice tribute. Thank you so much, 49er Faithful, for that. That means a lot to us, and we did love doing that show about Kelly Waymire. Also in the reviews, by Professor James Robb, 5-star rating, thank you so much. Good podcast, Will brings a ton to an honest discussion of Enterprise. So Will, little shout out for you. And that's pretty awesome. And of course, we can't thank Tommy enough, obviously, for his involvement with the show, because he also brings all this great Enterprise content and trivia to us on a weekly basis when he joins us on the show.
I really appreciate you saying that for me, even though it wasn't in the review. Makes me feel special.
Oh, you were there for Kelly's, and you were there for everything since we started the year and before with Christopher. So, you know, we love having you on the show, and you're always welcome here in the conference room and in the decon chamber when we get back there, when Phlox
right,
actually
right,
kicks us back in.
I still love the fact you say the conference room. It's like saying next time in the kitchen.
The conference room, right? So if you're not an Apple user, we've got you covered as well. You can find our shows on Stitcher, TuneIn, Spreaker, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, and of course you can stream and download the MP3 from our website and grab the RSS link as well. Another way you can help us keep all of our shows coming to you each week is to become a patron of the network on Patreon. If you visit patreon.com/trekfm, that's patreon.com/trekfm, you'll find our current goals and different milestone contribution levels, along with all the great perks we have for you. These perks include early access to content, exclusive content, producer credits, seats on our content development team, and more. We really appreciate any support you can give us and hope you'll join the team. Again, you'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. I would also like to say a special thank you to our associate producer for Warp 5, Floyd Dorsey. Thanks, Floyd, for all your support for the network through patreon.com, and you can find Floyd on the Babel Conference, Trek FM's dedicated Facebook listeners page. Now, if you'd like to get in touch with us here at the network on Trek FM, you can always find us on trekfm/contact and look in the sidebar page on the show page, or go to speakpipe.com/trekfm. You can also contact us through Twitter at Trek FM, Facebook, facebook.com/trekfm, and as I mentioned earlier, the Babel Conference. Type the Babel Conference, that's B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook, or go to our website at Trek FM and click discussion on the menu bar. Now, Will and Tommy, we've had a great conversation today, and I would love for the fans to be able to get in touch with you just in case they have any questions or like to give you any feedback, or even you, Will, to get more content as content coordinator for future shows for Trek FM and Warp 5. So please tell all of our listeners where they can find you across the internet.
Well, they can find me at Twitter at @Will_Nguyen. It's spelled N-G-U-Y-E-N. I'm always on there. I'm also always in the Babel Conference, which is Trek FM's dedicated Facebook listener group. And we have some really great discussions in there all the time. And of course, as Norm mentioned, I'm the content coordinator. So just drop me a line if you feel like there's something we should cover in the future across all the shows. So look forward to hearing from you.
And Tommy, how about you? How can our Facebook fans and listeners across the interwebs get in touch with you?
Well, when I'm not in the conference room, you can find me. I'm the main poster on the Star Trek Horizon Facebook page. That's pretty much the easiest way to get in touch with me. And that's facebook.com/STHorizon, or you can find it via searching on Facebook for Star Trek Horizon. I also do the Twitter, but not too often, and my Twitter name is Tommy G Dog, TommyGDawg.
And he has another account, Tommy Doggy Dog.
As Chris always likes to say.
As Chris always says.
Yeah. No, actually, it's Tommy G Doggy Dog.
Oh, my bad. Yeah.
Tommy G. That's the Section Dog. 31 account, right, yeah. So we don't really talk about it too much on the air. Thanks, guys, so much for participating for today. And, Will, we have definitely got more content to talk about, so make sure that you get those notes, and we can just continue the discussion offline and for future shows. So before we go, we'd like to ask everyone to please support our sponsor, who helps us bring Warp 5 and all of our shows to you each week. And our sponsor for this show is Audible.com. Audible is a great way for you to read all of the books you've always wanted to read, but never thought you'd have time for. As a Trek FM listener, you can get a free audiobook of your choice, along with a 30-day trial, just to see how great Audible is. Just go to audibletrial.com/trekfm and sign up today. Again, that's audibletrial.com/trekfm, and we thank Audible for supporting Warp 5 and the network. And don't forget to check out Enterprise in Space, a project of the nonprofit National Space Society that will design and launch an 8-foot orbiter and return the craft to Earth. The NSS Enterprise orbiter will carry more than 100 student-designed science experiments into space, and you can help make it happen. Visit enterpriseinspace.org to find out more and get your seat on the mission. Now, if you'd like to get in touch with me, you can always find me here on the network or on the Babel Conference. You can also find me on Twitter at Norman Lau, that's N-O-R-M-A-N-L-A-O. And I'm also a proud supporter of Alex Peters and the Axanar Project, and you can find me on the dedicated Axanar fan group page on Facebook. And lastly, I am a proud supporter of Trek FM through Patreon, and I'm an associate producer of 4 shows here on the network, Warp 5, The Orb, The 602 Club, and Axanar, the official Axanar podcast. So thanks everyone for listening, and join us once again next time here in the conference room for another episode of Warp 5.